Welcome, dear friends, to the 261st episode of the Serious TV Drama Podcast, coming at you station to station and coast to coast, from the tippy top of the Empire State all the way to the arches of the Golden Gate. Me, I'm the man making the podcasting plans, the man who now wears those goofy-ass cans, the man who sorta can sing, but he damn well can't dance. I'm known as Scott. Joining me tonight, the barrister, who's no baritone, who's coming at you via his smartphone. He's both a papa and a Rolling Stone. It's Brian. How are you doing this late Sunday evening, Brian?
Well, I'm doing really well, Scott, and I can't really compete with that snappy opening, so I'll just say hey.
I am really just trying to make up for my lackadaisical approach to my podcast introductions for the last couple of weeks between not really the ones with you, because we've been keeping it pretty short and sweet, but I'm more making up for the ones I've done with Dan with Dark, I think. Plus, I had a thought in my head earlier today that I really wanted to kick off the podcast with a, almost like a Walter Winchell style kind of opening, except I didn't have enough to drink before the podcast started, so I really couldn't get myself to do a Walter Winchell voice. So I just, whatever. I don't know if it sounded good or bad, but at least it was something. And as I was just mentioning to you before we started recording, this will be yet another one of my, or not my, one of our experimental podcasts, because for the first time ever, I am going to attempt to professionally, and by professionally I mean not just playing my iPhone over a microphone, I'm going to attempt to add both opening and closing music. So everyone who's listening to this podcast, if there was actually music before I spoke, that means it worked. And if the first thing you heard was me saying, welcome, then I screwed up again.
So Scott's technological evolution brought to you by COVID-19 quarantine, right?
Yeah, exactly. It pretty much is. I spent the whole $100 on this microphone. I want to get the most use out of it I can. But as fascinating as things like that are to me, I think the people who are, I was about to say, tuning in. Yes, I am Walter Winchell tonight. People are tuning in on our little radio sets to our podcast tonight. They're here to listen to us talk about Perry Mason. Now, obviously tonight was chapter 4, but before we get to that, and don't worry, it'll only be a couple minutes, kids, there were three matters I wanted to touch upon before getting to that. One is a bit more of a clarification, maybe a correction even, of something that we discussed and I had said a couple podcasts ago. The next is a little bit more of a reaffirmation or restatement of something I think we did both discuss, I think even on our last podcast, but I wanted to be really crystal clear with my certainty on it, regardless of what happened in tonight's episode. And I was actually worried, oh no, it's going to ruin my what I planned to talk about if they get to it before I can get to it, but they didn't. And then finally, a little last little bit about, well, a little bit of history involving one of the characters' storylines on this series that we've been talking about week after week. So the first thing, the correction or clarification, we had discussed, I believe it goes all the way back to the second episode, chapter 2. That was the episode where we were getting the flashbacks of Perry Mason in World War I, if I'm not mistaken. And we also got that scene during the episode that had E.B., Baggerly, and Perry Mason. And there was a bit of a back and forth between Mason and Baggerly, with Baggerly kind of insinuating that Mason had left the army due to, well, perhaps a homosexual act, that he had gotten a blue ticket or a blue card. I forget what the phrase was. And I think at the time, I kind of waved it off, including Mason's wise-ass response, which was also something along the lines of that he was like a quarter Welsh or a quarter Scottish, but only queer once or something. Anyway, I think I kind of just dismissed it and just went along with the idea that he had left the army or was dishonorably discharged from the army due to the acts we saw committed in those flashbacks. I thought about it afterwards and then forgot about it again, but I thought about it again recently, and I realized, no, that's not what happened. That's not what they said is actually sort of kind of why Perry Mason, how Perry Mason got out of the army. He didn't get dishonorably discharged for the fact he was shooting the other soldiers. Because quite frankly, if something like that had happened and they had caught him on that, it would have been far worse than just a dishonorable discharge. I mean, he would have been court-martialed for murder, quite frankly. He has the line about being queer only once because that was his way of getting out. So he did do something, and that was his way of getting out of the army. So that's why he says he's queer only once. I apologize that I might have minimized or just ignored that fact when we discussed it a few weeks ago, but it's almost, I think it's important only the fact that this is something that he felt he had to do in order to get out of the army. And it wasn't, and I feel like we kind of just disregarded it a little bit at the time. So I just wanted to clarify that was my thinking on it, or my belief is what happened, I should say.
Well, I will say that I will go rewatch that scene, and look at it again. It's interesting. We do these as, you know, within an hour or mm-hmm. two of the end of the episode. So, I try to keep my mind fresh. I don't read anything. I try not to study anything and just give an honest feedback reacting to the episode. And we've sort of tried to plan it that way, which is different than we podcasted most things in the past.
Right.
So I haven't went back and pored over it, but I will certainly go back and watch that scene with a new set of eyes, because I hadn't considered, and certainly this is a terrible comparison, but you know, I hadn't sort of considered like a Klinger approach to get out of the military, you know, like to come up with something to try to get out. And I'd not considered that. So that's, you know, an interesting read on that. And I'm certainly would like to look at it again with fresh eyes.
Yeah. I would say go back and watch, because you're aware of, well, for lack of a nicer way to put it, of the atrocities he actually committed during the war. And again, these were his own soldiers, which there's not, I don't know if there's really room for mercy killing, especially not wanton mercy killing like he was doing. He didn't just do it to one soldier either, you know. There's no way he wouldn't have been court-martialed and gone to the stockade, gone to prison, even executed perhaps. It would have been considered, regardless of knowing that it would be a merciful act, it would still be akin to treason. And the fact he uses the line queer only once, like, okay, you're definitely making it clear that you did this, you did do something, that was your way out, but you only did it the one time. And I did think of Klinger, and I kept thinking, hey, that would have been a way to get rid of Klinger's character really quickly in MASH. It's like, you know, he spent all that time dressing up, like, you know, if you just like, if you're just blown one dude, you could have gotten out.
Yeah, you totally commit.
Anyway, so that was number one. Number two, something that both of us discussed, and I think I'm pretty sure we kind of settled on this already, but I just wanted to, in case we weren't crystal clear about it. We had a discussion in a previous podcast about what we thought about Perry Mason as far as him having a law degree, being able to practice law, etc. And by the time we get to this episode, if it wasn't already crystal clear, and I use that phrase a couple times during this podcast, I forgive me for that. If it wasn't already obvious, that's a better way to put it. If it wasn't already obvious where this series was going to have to go, chapter four tonight certainly made it, guaranteed it, I would say, that Perry Mason is going to be a lawyer in this series. So correct me if I'm wrong. Did we both sort of come to the conclusion roughly that he's probably someone who had gotten his law degree, might have even gotten his law degree before he went to war? And then after that, and after everything, he probably has not practiced. Is that what we're thinking happened there?
I think our discussion was along the lines of he either got a law degree and maybe wasn't using it, or had studied and just maybe had never taken the bar. Or maybe even had been a lawyer and maybe had been disbarred or something, or been suspended from the practice of law.
We were juggling the possibilities.
Yeah.
All right. My feeling is that he had a law degree already. I don't believe he hasn't taken the bar. I think he has a law degree. And find out. We might find out next episode I'm totally wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure he has a law degree because I don't think we have time for him to get a law degree at this point. And, you know, perhaps based on, you know, number one, based on the events of the war itself, not to mention whatever has happened with his family, with his parents who have both passed away, the life he's led has not been one, doesn't lend itself to practicing law in as much as just being your own man and being a PI the way he's been, where you can kind of lead these somewhat, not reckless, I can't think of the right word to put it, or lackadaisical, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, there's a lot, as you know full well, there's a lot more that would go into him being a lawyer and the dependence that your clients would have on you and the day in, day out rigmarole, et cetera.
Well, I think you see in the episodes leading to where we are that he does have a lot of understanding of the law. I think that the piece that he doesn't have, I think, and this episode spelled it out really well, is that Della is going to fill in the gaps for what he's not great at in the law.
Right.
That early in the episode, she's talking about filing motions, doing a motion for suppression, all the things. You know, I'd sort of wondered if the show would go down that road. You see, she really is the central nervous system of that office. And so whatever Perry's not good at, she will probably be the one to fill those gaps for him.
As she puts in that scene with EB, but she is the associate.
Yes.
She's not merely, as I mentioned before, a secretary or his girl Friday kind of a situation. She is putting in the work, like a legal aide, like someone who may be in training to be a lawyer themselves, quite frankly. Yeah, but I just wanted to be clear on that, at least as far as my perspective. I don't want to speak for you, of course, but it was like, okay, I had already figured before tonight's episode, I was like, oh, he's definitely going to be a lawyer in this. It's just, there's no way around it, because why else would it be watching the slow decay and destruction of EB week after week? And then when we got to this episode, and I know I'm jumping ahead because I don't really mean to be talking about the episode just yet, but who cares? Because we've all seen it. As we go through this entire episode, it just became, you know, like one bell tolling after the other, like, oh, for sure it's going to happen. Because things are getting worse and worse for EB as we go through this entire episode until the final moments where, you know, yikes, maybe they went a little further than I thought they were going to go. We shall see. But we will get to that when we get to that. Let's get to the third little thing I wanted to bring up, and I'll try to be super quick about this. I can't recall if it was on the podcast, so I suspect maybe it might have been on the social media where someone, I guess, had asked about the Sister Alice character, wondering if that was... Oh, you know what? It was a friend of mine who's a bartender. I just remembered who it was. Okay. He hasn't even listened to the podcast, but who cares? He was asking me if the Sister Alice character was actually based on a real person or a real character. And I said, you know, I think she might be. So I finally got around to looking it up. And yes, indeed, Sister Alice does have... As to quote the article I'm going to read a teensy bit from, she does have a real-life counterpart. It was Amy Semple McPherson. Amy Semple McPherson, who was born back in 1890, she was a Protestant evangelist who was nationally famous pretty much around the same post-World War I period as we're seeing here in Perry Mason. She was a woman who first gained notoriety while traveling around the United States in a car with Jesus is coming soon, get ready. But she used to give the same kind of, you know, galvanizing, passionate, you know, prop-using sermons the same way we see Sister Alice doing it. I'm just going to skip through this because you don't need to hear everything about Miss McPherson. But she also dealt with a there was also a case of a kidnapping at the time that she dealt with. I'm just trying to find it. I really should have had it queued up here, and now I can't find it. She had a megachurch, a modern megachurch, which sounds eerily familiar, was broadcasting on the radio. See, there's so many things that are, she's basically, you know, the same character pretty much. I'm just trying to find it because I'm pretty sure. Oh, here we go. McPherson was involved in a kidnapping, but the catch is she herself might have been the kidnappee. She disappeared in 1926, so many people thought she had died. And then she reappears like a month later, you know, knocking on a stranger's door and claiming she had been held captive by three strangers. Now, obviously, it's a different sort of kidnapping, but it's just interesting that Sister Alice's character sounds a heck of a lot like this woman, and there was also kind of a wacky, scandalous kidnapping involving both of them, both in real life and in the Perry Mason series. So anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting enough to mention. She also died really young. She died in 44, so God, she was like 54. Jesus. Sounds like she might have committed suicide, in fact. Wow. So, interesting case. Might be something one, if you guys ever want to look into it, you know, maybe get a bit more of an insight into the Sister Alice character, perhaps. Again, that woman's name was Amy, A-I-M-E-E, McPherson Semple. Or is it Semple McPherson? Whatever. You know what I mean. Okay. Brian's like, all right, let's get on with it. Right? Come on.
Hey, history's a good thing.
I thought it was interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I say that I think it's interesting because, and now is where we're going to go right into chapter 4 of Perry Mason. I also admit that despite the performance, and there are some things that are, moderately interesting to me, I'm probably the least interested in the Sister Alice stuff on the series right now. Taking nothing away from Tatiana Maslany's performance. It's a fine performance. I'm enjoying her tremendously and so on. And even all the little supporting people around her. I can't lie and say I'm super engaged in it as opposed to I want to get back to the other stuff, regardless of how much it may factor into the actual case in the remaining half of the series. But that's just my personal feeling on it. Brian, you might feel differently about it. That's fine.
I think the way I feel about it, I'm still curious how they're going to tie these things together in a bigger way.
Right.
And if that's satisfying, it probably will be worth the time. If it's not, it probably will seem not as worth the time. But I think the intrigue of the church and seeing the relationship between her and her mother is, I mean, it's good. There's nothing bad about it.
Right.
I'm just not sure where it's headed. So and that's kind of a crappy thing to say, in that. You know, I guess my opinion of that story will be ultimately results-oriented, but the other stuff is so compelling and has a direction in which I want to go further down that road that I'm just a little more interested in it right now.
Yeah, I think with the Sister Alice storyline, I agree. I feel if there's a true payoff to this that ties in with what the rest of the story of the show is, then excellent, fine. I'm happy to have taken the journey, because again, the scenes are not boring. The scenes are well acted. They're well presented. Everything's great about them. I'm just not as interested in them as I am with the other things. Whereas the ongoing parts of the murder case, whether it be following Perry or Perry and Pete, or things with EB or things with EB and Della or Della, whatever, they're more circling around what the central storyline is. So even if a mystery is not solved per se in those scenes, the payoff feels more immediate because we're taking steps to get somewhere, and I can see where we're going. You know, I might not know what the final destination will end up being, but at least I understand the journey. I'm not as clear on that with the Sister Alice stuff. That said, still need to mention what actually happened on this episode, because there was some interesting stuff that happened. I mean, I mean, and I think we can just cover it all in one fell swoop. We don't need to bounce back and forth during the podcast to talk about it. Just get it all out of the way now, so to speak. You know, it's like taking your medicine before you can have your treats. I don't know. You know, Sister Alice is convalescing at home, and outside her house, you have whatever you wish to call them. The followers, the acolytes, the parishioners, whatever. They seem to be gathering there. The thing that happens at the beginning of the episode where that little family comes in and the girl comes bearing a gift and it turns out she's bearing snakes. First of all, that kid, and I don't mean the actual actress, just I'm talking about within the story of the show, that kid's a great actress.
Yes, yes.
Because how many kids, you know, could pull that off? Could be like all syrupy, sweet, and perfect, and God-fearing, and then all of a sudden go right into becoming, you know, like she might as well be Reagan. She might as well be spitting, you know, green bile out of her mouth by the end of that scene.
Yeah. I thought that the family that was a interesting way to start the episode with her parishioner and learning that there's now this split within the church, and they say pretty much in the episode. The church is split about halfway down the middle between the people who want to, I think her mother says, half of them want to kiss your feet and the other half think you're a blasphemer. And, and so then we see the politics of the church. We get a little more. We also learn that, she apparently has had these sort of seizures before. The doctor says she, has had an epileptic seizure, and prescribes rest and convalescence. And, you see, I think something we wondered about with her schedule was her mother pushing her, and how much was her feeding this machine of this church. And, you know, that's sort of coming to a head quickly.
Absolutely. And although there may be a split among, you know, the people who go to the church, the people who run the church, the church board, not really much of a split there. Once you get past, you know, Mother McKeegan, that's how you pronounce her name, McKeegan, right? Yeah, they're all pretty much not in favor of the direction Sister Alice is going in. It's interesting that they bring up that she's, by talking of things like resurrection, this takes you back to almost like carnival shows and revival shows and, snake charmers and such. So it's no coincidence that the family that comes and they bring snakes. Snakes are not just emblematic, you know, the classic emblematic of evil. They also harken back to those kind of things. So it all kind of fits together really nicely.
Let me add one thing before I forget. Sure. In the drip and drab storytelling that we love about this show, I was really curious. She makes one offhanded comment that they don't explore any further. When she says to her mom about hearing the voice of God in her head, she says, "Do you remember what he told me in Oklahoma?" Mm-hmm, right. And they just move on. And I thought, you know, that part of the story, you know, I guess if I look at it and think back on it as we talk about it, I do want to know what happened in Oklahoma. And so, you know, there is the device of the way they're telling the story even keeps us interesting, although I don't know where it's going. So
right. Well, although it'd be weirdly coincidental if we do find out and it turned out to be something connected to, you know, Tulsa, Oklahoma in the 20s or something. It's like, oh my God, another Watchmen connection. Oh my God.
Yeah.
but basically to put a button on things. I mean, essentially the Sister Alice storyline beyond the fine details that we've mentioned. That's what happens in the opening. We see arguing among the church board who have all pretty much banded against them. Pretty much, and of course, everyone else on the board are men. So, and Baggerly, who's already shown himself to be, let's just say, more than a little bit chauvinistic, we can put it that, you know, it's a nice way to put it. So they're basically opposed to the quote-unquote hysterical women. And finally, when we get to the final moments with Sister Alice in this episode, it looks like she is prepared to, you know, renounce her blasphemy as far as resurrection and so on. And perhaps she, who knows how far she would have gone. Maybe she misheard God. Maybe this, that, or the other thing. Until a man cuts through the crowd you know, to give her a baby blanket to, you know, to give to Charlie when he does rise from the dead. And then she just goes right back to what she was saying before, you know, about Emily Dodson being innocent, which we kind of agree with, and that she will be raising the kid from the dead, you know, I don't know, like around Easter or something like that. That, not so sure about that one.
That would be impressive. And we do learn, to sort of go along with the way we've structured this podcast, we did learn something, that we did get confirmation that it's 1932 in this episode. We were wondering, was it 31, 32? We knew the ballpark, but it said right. Explicitly
they said
in this episode.
Okay.
Yep.
No, I wasn't. My confusion was, I remembered hearing that the show takes place in 1932. But then we hit New Year's Eve pretty early on, and I wasn't sure, wait, is it becoming 1932 now?
Or right.
Is it becoming 1933? Because there's right. a huge difference between those two. The fact that, as you point out, it must have just turned 1932 makes more sense to me. Because like I said, there would have been a different feeling about things because it would have been, you know, FDR is about to be inaugurated as president. It would have been signaling a major shift in the country at the beginning of 33 as opposed to 32. So it does make a lot more sense. So getting back to the episode in the middle of all this, the next thing we had, it was Della and E.B. And we've kind of talked about this a little bit, this early scene between Della and E.B. This was where Della was insisting that E.B. use the information about, you know, the police basically interrogating and, you know, slapping around Emily Dodson, and he'd be insisting that he wouldn't want to waste that here. He would rather use that during the course of a trial with a judge and jury. And then we pretty much smash cut to E.B. trying to use it after all in order to get Emily Dodson's bail reduced. But it's clearly not working. The judge does not agree that the bail should be lowered. And we see Barnes is continuing to outfox E.B., who is once again caught unaware about something. This time it's about Matthew Dodson waiving his spousal privilege, and apparently he is going to be testifying against his wife.
Yes, and I did like the scene of there was an interesting footnote in that. E.B., obviously, there's some feeling about Oliver Wendell Holmes, who's a, you know, well-known Supreme Court judge. There aren't a lot of Supreme Court justices that are household names. A whole lot of them have served, and you know, you may recognize a name here or there. He's one of the more, I don't want to say popular. It's not like he's popular, but he's well known.
I would say for the first half of the century, he's like one of the most iconic names connected to the Supreme Court that I can think of. Because he basically, even I know that name.
Yeah.
That and the Frankfurter guy.
Yes. he's a well known jurist and Supreme Court justice. And so E.B. sort of ties a distinction with him that he refers to with the judge. And it is interesting to see the judge say, you know, I don't want to hear any more crap out of your detectives that after he hears the arguments in his chambers. And the sort of the sad thing as we follow E.B.'s thread through this is he got more of the district attorney's goat than he realized.
He never gets the satisfaction for actually pulling off what he was hoping to there. Right.
Yes. And he really did. He really did score a point that he didn't know he scored, but by that point, his confidence and the things happening around him had laid him low enough that, you know, he didn't get to see that through, and that's kind of tragic. And if we follow him through the episode, his last interaction with Della was not great, and Perry just sort of says, can I go run back down what I want? And he waves him off. And I don't really think E.B. was headed down the road where it ended until he talked to his client in the jail.
Right.
And I think he was overwhelmed. He heard himself trying to force her to plead guilty, and he knew she was innocent. And when she, something in him broke when he knew that he was hurting her by asking her just to give up 20 years of her life. And I don't know if he felt that ashamed of what he did or just felt like he couldn't win the case for her.
Right.
But to see his journey starting there and the way it goes from Della and weaves throughout the indignity of not being able to get, you know, a loan. And he wants to get her out of jail. And the truth is, if your client gets out of jail prior to trial, that you do better right. at trial than if they're in jail.
Right.
And that's proven. I mean, it's statistically true. And so when he failed there and failed her, his story was really, I mean, it was really a sad one, but there was... You saw flashes of his brilliance and commitment.
Yeah.
And it was just a sad ending.
In a way, if I could just kind of tick them off, it kind of reminds me a little bit of every once in a while you watch a TV episode, an episode of a TV series, I should say, which is basically about one bad day. And it mm-hmm. there's a famous Breaking Bad episode for Jesse, where Jesse just has one really bad day. You know, like one thing after the other. It's just a horrible day. And I believe we've seen that a few more times. I just don't have any examples in front of me because I want to get back to Perry Mason. This episode, I mean, it starts off with EB and Della. It seems like, okay, they're having this discussion. But when we the moment we smash cut, the moment he's actually doing exactly what he said he wasn't going to do, which already speaks of his desperation in the moment. Because we already know, without having seen whatever first few minutes of that scene, that he's at a point where his only recourse is to use that information out of hopes of lowering his client's bail, and even that doesn't work. So that's like failure number one. Then Barnes hits him with the news about Matthew Dodson is going to testify against his wife. So it's like failure number two, but because you A, didn't see this coming, B, that's not good. Then he has the interview with the Beverly Hills Post. And that, on the face of it, seems like there's nothing out of the ordinary really happened in that scene. He's espousing his actually, it's in that scene, he's espousing his adoration or admiration, I should say, for Oliver Wendell Holmes and about a sense of justice and yada, yada, yada. But the problem is, it becomes clear when the journalist finally asks him a question, they don't care. They don't care about the case. They don't care about that. They ask him about where he likes to eat. It's more of a, it's the Beverly Hills Post. So maybe it's more, I don't know this, if it actually exists or not, or maybe it's just more of a gossipy rag as opposed to some, more esteemed publication. Then, as you were saying, the fact that he can't get that loan, is just sadder than sad, especially when he keeps referring to the person he used to work with who doesn't even work at the bank anymore. So it's not just the fact that scene underscores that he's desperate for money. It's also that he doesn't have the status. He doesn't have the juice anymore. He's kind of like a creature from another time. I can't, the phrase I'm trying to look for? I can't think of the phrase right now. You know what I mean? He's just, time has passed him, so to speak.
Yeah, he's a man out of time. He's a dinosaur, and his world is disappearing. And what was big and important in his day, things have changed. And his desperation. What you see is him throughout the entire episode pushing out false bravado when in fact, like, everything's falling apart. And I think probably the most telling thing was when Della finds him and they have their showdown finally, that just in the meeting with the DA, that the DA had brought up the clients that he had moved money in the escrow accounts from. Mm-hmm. And he has all those files like a crazy person spread out around the office, trying to pore over those files to make sure, you know, that there's not really a case or, you know, to insulate himself against that. And, right. You know, that is the ultimate in sadness, because he's so scared and so upset at that point that that's what pushes him to the confrontation with Della. And I think Della's probably going to be pretty devastated that she chose that day to take off when yeah. we come back.
Absolutely. One of the things that really works about the EB storyline in this episode, as we watch the thread and we watch how it proceeds, it's almost an entirely a self-contained story, because we then get, after the things I had already listed, we actually get the moment, how do I put this? You know, it's not the false conclusion. We get a moment where suddenly things are looking good. False hope might be a good way to put it.
Yeah.
When he's speaking with Perry, and Perry actually, you know, gets through to him about there has to be a fourth man, when he goes on about, you know, what their investigation has turned up as of yet so far. And the fact that EB almost seemed like he's renewed a little bit by this, and he thinks he can go and confront Barnes with it. And he's also trying to bluff. He's obviously trying to bluff with his with what's in his satchel. There's nothing in his satchel. We know there's nothing in that satchel. But the problem is, Barnes kind of sort of probably knows that too. And that's when Barnes comes out with the whole thing that you were just mentioning, which is, wow, if we didn't think Barnes was maybe kind of sort of a bad guy in this, the fact that he has all this information and files on the opposing attorney about the fact that, as you said, he's been misappropriating client funds for years. And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm pretty sure I'm not, because I'm pretty sure this is how it works no matter what field you're in. It doesn't matter that EB has insisted that he's paid every penny back.
Nope.
It was still money that was stolen in the first place. It's still, again, correct me if I'm wrong, that's still pretty much grounds for disbarment.
If you move money, if you mess with your client's money from an escrow fund, that is discipline. That is, yeah, at the very minimum, bar discipline and possibly a criminal charge, right, depending on what's occurred. And what's I found really different in that is he gives him three choices. He doesn't say plead her or I disbar you. He says plead her or go to trial, or this letter goes out. And it's almost like that's the ultimate insult to EB. Like, you know, go to trial because you're a loser and I'm going to kick your ass at trial.
Exactly. It's exactly what I was thinking. And I remember having the exact same thought. Like, oh man, he's not just saying plead her out or this is going to happen. He's still daring him to go to trial, because that he's done nothing other than dropping the idea of the fourth man. And that's more of a Perry Mason thing than an EB thing, I think, in Barnes's mind, about there being even a shade of doubt about his case. He's still pretty damn confident he can pretty much wipe the floor with EB, because every time we've seen them together, that's what he's been doing. You know, and yes, every time they've interacted in this series, Barnes has the upper hand, or gets the upper hand. And this is no different. And then, like you said, the scene with him and Della. Whoa. I mean, you felt for both characters, because you could understand her exasperation, her frustration, because even when one views it as this is the early 1930s, clearly there are going to be gender issues at play here, and the way she would be perceived or treated, even by good people, so, quote unquote, they would still perceive her a certain way. And the fact is that she's been the one kind of propping things up for some time with this little law firm here. And the fact that he's going through all this and he doesn't, or maybe feels like he can't tell her just why it is he has files from, 1915 to 1918 everywhere scattered around the office. He doesn't tell her. He doesn't even try to tell her what's going on. He's humiliated. He's embarrassed. It's a really powerful scene especially for her. I thought she, I forget the name of the actress playing Della Street off the top of my head. And she looks like she's related to a couple actresses, but I know she's not part of that family. She's not one of the familias, but she always looks like a little bit like she could be related to Vera. I probably mispronounced her name just now. Sorry.
She certainly has been of the cast. She's been a revelation in this show, and her character arc and her story, her strength, has been really something to behold, and we see that a lot in this episode. And that exchange was two people having a fight about two completely different things. And that's what I think worked, that both it made it really tragic for him on one level, but on her level, her seeing that as just disrespect and not being appreciated is completely understandable as well. And you also see, and I thought it was great the way they laid it out. Not only does she do his legal work, she picks up his clothes, she picks him up and drives him to the office and takes him home. That he is so dependent upon her, that she has propped it up. And the line, my name's on the door. Will you see the associates? I'm the associates.
Oh yeah.
I thought that was very powerful, and I feel for her when she finds out what happened in the aftermath of this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, on one hand, she might take it the worst because there's going to be a certain amount of guilt she's going to have as. Combined with everything else, the fact that this is the person she's been working alongside, for who knows how many years now. I don't remember. They actually do make a reference to it. Obviously, it's been a while.
And then, like the 1920s, I think, because she says, I've kept the file since 1924.
Yeah, 1924. I think. So therefore 8 years. There you go, 8 years. That's a pretty long time. Or Perry Mason, who obviously this is a person who's played, kind of like a father figure. He's a mentor, et cetera, to him. So he's probably going to be hit pretty hard by the news as well. As you mentioned before, he goes to see Emily in prison. And initially he is trying to get her to plead, to plead out, even though it's obviously going against his grain to do that. But he doesn't really see a choice. He has probably lost all confidence in himself. He doesn't believe he has any necessary means or evidence that's going to be able to prove the case. As he even says something along the lines of that Perry Mason, he hasn't come up with the evidence that they need just yet. But her clear innocence to him kind of breaks his heart, and he does insist that, we're not going to do this. We're going to fight. And then the next time we see him is when he... And I kind of felt that's what they were doing from the get-go, the way they were setting that up. And in my mind, I was going, he's going to take his own life after making that promise to Emily. And it kind of, this might sound a little goofy, I don't know, it kind of further fueled the thing I let off the podcast talking about, or one of the things I let off, I should say, about Perry being a lawyer. Because I can't help but think that would be at somewhere in his thinking that he wouldn't just kill himself and leave her to die, that he in his mind would think that Perry would end up, picking up the gauntlet or whatever the phrase is. I might be reading too much into it, but that's the way I'm choosing to read the scene, at least.
Well, I think the line that leapt out to me that sort of put my hackles up. And then when I started watching his morning prep, I thought, oh, no, I think this is happening, is when he says, promise me you'll keep fighting. Because, I mean, not that a defendant doesn't need to keep their spirits up and doesn't need to keep fighting and have perseverance. But it's almost like he was asking her permission to get off her case by killing himself, knowing that she would still fight if he wasn't there. And you know what I'm saying? And I think you're right that in his mind, he has two very capable people that he knows because we see Perry totally believe she's innocent. When he's telling EB about the fourth man theory, and the way Della's talking about it, about her being it, he knows that if she will continue to fight, they are invested in her and believe in her innocence. But he needs to know if he's not there, she won't give up.
Right. Yeah, there is something about that. I think you're absolutely dead on with that. I mean, that's kind of like waving a little flag. Uh-oh, he's already perceiving he may not be long for this world. And this doesn't sound like it's simply tied to the fact that we have seen in previous episodes. And his coughing a little bit in this episode, I guess, but more the blood in that previous episode, that he might not be long for this world anyway, that he might, there's probably something wrong with EB, probably a form of, one would guess, cancer. That would be my first thought. So yeah, it was, and do you believe we've talked a lot about this episode and we've spent most of it talking about EB?
that's what's amazing. I mean, yeah. This was an EB-centric episode.
Oh, absolutely. Before we get to the obvious stuff we haven't talked about yet, which would be Perry Mason himself, because you know, as far as this specific episode is concerned, I've hardly talked about him. Can I just give a shout-out to the scene, since it doesn't feature any of our main protagonists. It features all of our antagonists. The scene with Barnes and the two detectives in the bathroom.
Oh, wonderful.
It's my favorite scene in the entire episode. I'm as I've said before, huge Stephen Root fan. To get to see him fucking screaming bloody murder at these two, clearing the room. Also, that actor who I remember from movies like In the Company of Men, among others, having his brief appearance in the bathroom. And Barnes actually tells him, "Did you wash your hands?" He gets to wash his hands, but he doesn't get to dry them.
Yeah.
But I really, really loved that whole scene because that was, as you were saying, that's the moment where you realize, oh, EB did get to him a little bit, did crack that veneer just a little bit. And even though although both detectives are corrupt, but one of them we know is really corrupt, i.e. murderer, Detective Ennis, also, I love him because it's the early 1930s, so people use the word bum all the time back then. And the fact that, Perry Mason's a bum, and only a bum would hire a bum. It's like, all right, bum, ba-dum, bum, bum. He's a bum. But still, let's find out because he still seems like he's got more on the ball than you guys have. But I just wanted to make, I don't know if there's much to analyze in that scene other than I'm finding Stephen Root's, what do you call it? What's the actor? John Waters' like mustache funnier and funnier every time I see it. There's something about that, just that little thin mustache.
There's almost like a reptilian quality he's playing this character with that he sort of plays with EB, but now we see behind the mask. And when he's in that room, I mean, you see the power he exudes to clear the room. The way he is with the detectives, and we learned two interesting pieces of information in that scene. One is, you know, the sort of dirty cop who's not the worst guy. I forget his name, but you know, you have the real bad cop, and then the other guy,
Holcomb, I think.
Holcomb. I think that's right. That we learn, like, they were trying to sweat her for 3 days to get a confession. So we learn he's a pretty bad dude, too. And we also learn the DA wanted them to get that confession and knew they were doing it to her for 3 days. And so he's not only going to use what he can, he's pretty dirty. Yep. But what I like about the scene is it's not explicit in establishing anybody other than the other detective is still the one in on the kidnapping. And when you leave that scene, all three of them could still somehow be involved in a conspiracy based on what they talked about. And it didn't rule that out, but it didn't include them as well. So it was vague enough to leave possibilities on the table, but it told you something about all three of those guys.
Okay. Yeah, I think I will agree with your unexpected breakdown of that scene, Brian. Good job.
What I love about this show, and I mean every week I feel like I talk about it more, is, and I apologize to the listeners if this is too repetitive or boring, but you know, we've joked about, or are we going to see these little characters and how well it's written? You know, just the one off of, you know, the chubby guy kicking his butt in the telephone booth and coming back from episode one to appear at the time. He's now getting to talk to his son, which we dealt with in a previous episode and the terrible New Year's Eve call. Mm-hmm. And then we also have, you know, tie-ins of all these other little pieces, and we get like some more comedy with the medical examiner.
Absolutely.
I mean, that was so unexpected to see him outside of the morgue going out to the house, and the way they weave these characters in and out through this show, this was another amazing episode with just amazing writing doing that.
There was more than a few kind of either interesting or just out and out fun callbacks to things that we saw in the very first episode. Everything dealing with the chubby Carmichael character, from the newspaper photograph all the way to him actually, as you just referenced, him kicking his ass in the telephone booth. That's all from, you know, chapter one, as well as the New Year's call to trying to speak to his son. And now he actually is speaking to his son. That was also, if I'm not mistaken, at the end of episode one, if I'm not mistaken. I'm pretty sure I'm right about that.
I think that's right.
And even because throughout this episode in the series, you know, we're supposed to be following Perry Mason, the PI. And in this episode, we got a lot of, you know, quote unquote, private investigator work with Perry and Pete together working on the case. And a lot of that was them kind of recreating or recounting the steps of what happened that night. So we see that location again, and we see that trolley car that comes down the elevated hill, whatever the heck that thing is in LA. There, these are all again recalling images as well as them retelling us what happened in the first episode. So a lot of chapter four is actually calling back or replaying what happened in chapter one. The fact that they, since, because he mentioned the morgue guy, so we got to get to this. The fact that Perry and Pete actually stole the body from the other morgue. And number one, that's like, what? Okay. Number two, the fact that they thought they could bring Virgil to his house and, you know, just by being nice to the guy, would somehow be able to talk him into doing an autopsy of the guy for them. What?
Yeah.
And then finally, the idea, which apparently sort of kind of works, although someone's going to be wondering how it got there, they decide apparently to dump the body in a sand trap at a local golf course and make sure that golf course is in the territory that's covered by or under the purview of Virgil's morgue, as opposed to the county morgue. So now Virgil is going to end up having to give an autopsy to the guy, because as they point out, it's not simply that they were able to match that dental plate to the guy's mouth. Well, he also had a bullet hole in his shoulder. Kind of hard to, you know, what, he shot himself in the shoulder before he blew his own head off? That doesn't really compute. So these were all important pieces of evidence, you know, as far as building the case of there has to be a fourth man. And of course, one of the, I don't want to say it's one of the unfortunate things about the series, because that's a bit of an overstatement, but I will confess I kind of wish I didn't know who the fourth man was. I kind of wish they had just somehow just done it in shadow or something. We never, and I know that might have come off as a bit of a cheesy device or something, and maybe most of us would have just guessed it was the cop anyway. Maybe that's why. But there's part of me that, unless there, as we've spoken about in a previous podcast, unless there is we mentioned there's some other underworld figure, but that's not someone that we've met before, so I don't know if that is going to have any meaning to me. I would have appreciated the mystery being someone that hadn't been uncovered right from the get-go. I didn't need Columbo is one thing. I don't mind knowing who the killer is at the beginning of Columbo. I don't know if I want it on this series, but let me see how the next four episodes unfold. Because I say that, and then part of my brain is going, yeah, but then the scene when Perry finds him at the Elks Club auction is not half as much fun if you don't already know that he's actually, you know, the fourth guy who murdered everybody else. That makes that scene work so much better. So I understand why they did it. I'm just saying part of me wishes we didn't know, but then I see a scene where it works so well that I gotta, you know, I guess my mind is of two different schools on this one.
No, I feel similarly, but we add the Elks Lodge to the mix in an interesting way. And the way they weave through the scene and retrace the steps of what would make sense and how you would go and then end up in that auction. The thing about Perry is at this point, he's not the morally upright Perry Mason you think of your later years in the, you know, television show. And I thought it was really interesting him and that detective in that auction. You know, he doesn't really threaten his daughter, but you could take it that way. Hmm. He goes, boy, I hope she has a great time at camp. which is a callback to what, you know, that to the way that guy talked to Drake and his wife, like, you're going to have a baby soon. That'd be good for that baby. And it was sort of using a tactic he's used in a similar way against him that I thought was because, you know, Perry is kind of, he's an unknown, and if he's a bum, I'm not sure they wouldn't be a little bit worried that he would be, you know, not afraid to do anything. They know he would break in and, you know, search an apartment. They've caught him doing that. So I like that scene. And I like that there's a nugget in Perry's head that he's somebody to look at because of all the coincidences.
Yes, absolutely. And seeing him there just made it kind of underscore that, I thought. I use underscore a lot in these podcasts. I would say I definitely enjoyed the episode. It's not my favorite of the series so far, but certainly is pushing things along. I'm more and more intrigued to see the very next episode now. The repercussions of EB, we are assuming, rightfully so, that no one suddenly bursts in at the last minute and saves him, and that he actually does commit suicide. And we shall see if Perry stepping up to the plate to be a lawyer is going to happen, you know, perhaps sooner than some of us thought. Although, on the other hand, it would have been ridiculous if they wait till like some point during the final episode, and now Perry Mason is actually going to be a lawyer. Like, really? Watch, that's what they do. And I'll have to walk that whole thing back in a future podcast.
Maybe, but there's another point I'd like to touch on, if you don't mind. And that is, we've seen throughout the series, Della defending what you do in your personal life shouldn't mean you're a murderer. And now we discover why that touches so close to home to her, because she has a secret that at that time, if discovered, would have probably had disastrous consequences for her.
Yes.
And so you see why, in a way, she is so relatable to Emily Dotson in her own mind, that to just be vilified for who you slept with or what personal life choices you made apart from what you do is such a huge deal to her. And so, you know, they color that picture in a little more for us.
Yeah. It's interesting. Once again, we have the fire engine sirens in New York.
Special guest.
I just finished watching Fahrenheit 451 last night. I'm supposed to be the fireman coming to burn some books. I'll kind of want to end it here, but it's interesting with the TV series from the 50s and 60s, which was pretty much, I guess one could sort of call it a procedural of its time, and the books themselves, which were great mystery novels, but they didn't do very much delving into the characters and their backstories. They were very sketchily, deliberately sketchily done. So you didn't know very much about the history or back history of Perry Mason or of Della Street and so on. So it affords the writers and creators of this series like, oh, we pretty much have free reign, you know, as long as no one from the Earl Stanley Gardner estate objects. I'm assuming they'd have to get some okays for stuff. But so that way you can have Perry Mason be, you know, he's kind of a traumatized war veteran who might have committed a certain considered salacious act at the time in order to get out of the army. Paul Drake can now be a man of color as opposed to, you know, the white bread that he was before. And Della can, well, play for the other team, I guess. I don't know how else to put it. Probably not the most PC way to rephrase that, but whatever, it's late. You know what I mean. So she's playing on the other side of the street. Anyway. You see, this is why I want to keep the podcast under an hour. I'm watching the clock. We're hitting the hour mark. I know things are going to get derailed, and that's going to be me doing it. There you go. So I am looking forward to next week's episode most definitely.
Yes, I this episode for me went really fast. When I got to about the 45-50 minute mark, I thought, oh my God, it's almost over. And I really enjoyed the pacing, the way it delivered the story, and I want to see what the aftermath of EB's death is.
Yeah, absolutely. That is the key thing I'm looking forward to for the next episode and what the repercussions will be. Okie doke. So if you enjoyed this podcast, guess what? You'll probably enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's devoted to the podcast. It's called the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. Like the page and join the conversation about shows like Perry Mason, like Dark, like Better Call Saul. Did I not make a Jimmy McGill reference in this podcast? I wanted to. There were so many Jimmy McGill-like things in this episode, but didn't get a chance to. Oh, well. Anyway, you can also find us on iTunes. Apparently it still exists. Maybe it's called Apple something. I don't freaking know. But if you find us there, you can subscribe to us there, and you can rate and review us there as well. You can also go to our web page or web host page, whatever the heck it's called. It's stvdpodcast.podbean.com. And you can go through all 261 podcast episodes of the Serious TV Drama Podcast. You know, three or four of them aren't bad. And finally, you can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. So that is it for now. Brian, you and I will be getting back together to do the next Perry Mason episode. Well, pretty probably a week from tonight.
Yep.
There is a rumor. I don't think it'll be for the next episode, though it's conceivable, but maybe for the one after that. Someone's making noises about wanting to join us for at least one, or if not more, of these podcasts, if he's able to suddenly watch all the episodes and such. We shall see. I think it's been nice not having him. No, I'm just kidding. We'll see. So we will be getting back together for this next week. I hear my computer making weird noises, so I want to hurry up and finish this up. I'm also going to be releasing the final Dark podcast in a few days. I think, what's today? Monday. Yeah, Wednesday. So that's July 13, 14, 15. On the 15th, I believe, I'll be releasing the final Dark podcast. Just wanted to put some space in between these, not have them release them like one after the other. And after that, I don't know, it's just going to be Perry Mason for a while, and we'll see. There's a I've said it before, there's a chance we might podcast about one or two other things this summer. Depends on our stamina and our mood and what we feel like talking about. Maybe Umbrella Academy season 2? That's a possibility. Hey, Brian, I'm now caught up on Doom Patrol. Just for the heck of it, maybe we do a Doom Patrol podcast.
Sounds like a one-off.
I feel like it's a strong possibility. We could just cover all of season 1 and up and wherever we are in season 2. It's pretty damn good. We'll see. Anyway, but we will stop here. Again, if you hear music at the beginning and end of this podcast, that means I was able to get things done correctly. If not, I apologize. I wanted to end this week's podcast with a different piece of music for a change, because within the last couple of weeks, I forgot the exact date. I didn't mention it last time around. One of the greatest movie score composers of all time passed away, Ennio Morricone. Sure, you're a fan as well. If Dan was here, he'd be going on about Once Upon a Time in the West, which, you know, great score there. Other people usually go right to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I'm more of a fan of Fistful of Dollars myself. But I thought it would be kind of neat to end this podcast with one of my favorite pieces of his music, a piece of music for a movie that also took place, much like Perry Mason, in the 1930s. So I thought it was... That's probably about as much of a connection as I can make to Perry Mason, other than everyone wearing fedoras. But if I'm able to do this correctly, you should be hearing one of my favorite pieces of movie music in about a minute or two. And if the last thing you hear is either me or Brian's voice, it means, hey, apparently I don't know what the heck I'm doing after all. So with that, I will say thank you again, Brian, and good night to everybody out there.
Thanks, Scott, and everybody have a great week. And Perry, sell Lupe the damn house. See you next week.
Good night, everybody.